United States, bringing with it gusting winds and cool temperatures. It has also prompted warnings of heavy snowfall and blizzard conditions for parts of Wyoming and Colorado. Forecasters with the National Weather Service have predicted 2 days of snow and near-blizzard conditions starting early today for Cheyenne and the northern Colorado Front Range. The storm could bring 12 to 18 inches of snow to the Cheyenne area through tomorrow. Yesterday, the system brought heavy winds and dust to portions of Nevada, Arizona, and California. Winter storm warnings are posted for southwest Wyoming and parts of Colorado and Nebraska. Cheyenne already has had snowy October with 14 inches so far. The average for the month is 3 inches. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy.
Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia de Camera, presenting Exploring the New World on Saturday, November 7th at 7:30 p.m. in the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. More information is available at 333-6280. Support for today's broadcast comes from Prevena Covenant Medical Center, a nationally ranked healthcare system by Thomson Reuters. The physicians and staff at Prevena encourage you to join them in supporting WILL.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, for the first hour today, we'll be dipping into the Focus 580 archives for a program first broadcast earlier this year. We'll be back live hour number two, but for this first hour, we'll not be taking calls. This morning, in this hour of focus, we'll explore some of the history of Ellis Island. It was officially opened in 1892 and closed in 1954 and was, for many years, America's main immigration station. Something like 12 million people came there seeking admission to the United States. Our guest, historian Vincent Cannata, says that this small island was also the place where the United States worked out its national debate about immigration. He says the story of Ellis Island is the story of a nation struggling with what it means to be an American. This morning, in this hour, we will be talking about his new history of Ellis Island. The book is titled American Passage, and Harper is the publisher. Our guest, Vincent Cannata, teaches history at the University of Massachusetts at Boston. He has written for the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, also the author of a previous book, The Ungovernable City, John Lindsay and His Struggle to Save New York. Professor Cannata, hello.
Hello, David. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks very much for being with us. You know, I realize that indeed a lot of people had passed through Ellis Island. I am, though, impressed by the statistic that something like 40% of Americans today can say that at least one of their ancestors had passed through Ellis Island.
Yeah, that's the general number that's thrown around, you know, give or take a few percent, but you know, when you think about it, 12 million immigrants came through during the peak period, 1892 to 1924, and through intermarriage and so forth. A lot of Americans today of various different ethnic backgrounds, not just Europeans, but also people from the Middle East, people from the Caribbean, can trace an ancestor through Ellis Island.
And it's an even more impressive number when that's still 12 million people is a lot of people. But when you consider that the population of the country was much smaller then than it is now, that makes that 12 million loom even larger.
Yeah, we tend to lose sight of that. We have lots of immigrants today that come into the country on any given year. It's roughly the same as during the peak years in the early 20th century. But back then, we were a nation about a quarter the size of what we are today. So a million people in 1907 was four times, would be equal to 4 million immigrants coming in a year today.
You have a personal connection yourself? Some of your family came through Ellis Island?
Yes, on my dad's side, I have my grandfather, my father's father came through. My father's grandfather came through, and he had a couple of uncles who came through. So I have a father, a great-grandfather, and two great-uncles.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that before Ellis Island was established, every state had its own immigration laws and enforced them. Even at that time, the main intake station was New York because it was the biggest port, but each state handled this as a matter of state law. What was it that was happening at this point, say, in the late 1800s that moved the federal government to decide that this was something that it should take control of?
The late 1800s see this, you know, huge boom in America, an economic boom, industrial boom, the second great industrial revolution. You get monopolies and trusts being formed, and many of the laws governing business tended to be state laws. And at this period, more and more Americans are starting to say, no, states aren't, you know, aren't equipped to deal with it, and this is a national issue, you know, whether it's trusts or monopolies or immigration. These are national issues, and only something as large as the national government can handle it. Actually, the national government wasn't that large then, but this is the beginning of the time when you see the growth of Washington, of the federal government, the bureaucracy there, the administrative state, as some people say, which is going to begin to regulate private business. And immigration really was seen at this time as a business, an economic issue. It was overseen by the Department of the Treasury, and it was most of the commissioners of immigration were labor people. It was a labor business issue. And so it seemed only natural if you were going to regulate trusts and monopolies and railroads that the federal government also begin to regulate immigration.
Mm. Before Ellis Island was set up, a lot of people came to the country by coming to New York, and the main intake station there was a place called Castle Garden. What was Castle Garden like?
Well, Castle Garden, you can still see a remnant of it today. It's in the Battery Park at the tip of Manhattan. If any of your listeners have gone to Ellis Island or the Statue of Liberty, it's the place where they buy their tickets today for the ferry. It's now a circular, it's restored to its old fort. It was a fort that was built as part of the New York Harbor defense for the War of 1812. Later, a second story was added to it. It became a concert hall, and it was New York's Carnegie Hall in the early to mid-1800s, and then they converted it into an immigration reception station run by the state of New York, in addition to immigrant aid societies. Irish and German immigrant aid societies assisted the state of New York in running the station. And it was largely designed to help immigrants. The belief was that immigrants who came to New York were being taken advantage of, con men, thieves, pimps, others. They were called runners. They made lots of money off the immigrant trade, basically taking advantage of the immigrants. So Castle Garden is there not just to process immigrants, but also to protect them from these runners, to assist immigrants in looking for work, and so on. So it was as much a benevolent association as it was a kind of government inspection station.
Mm-hmm. So Ellis Island, this even before the station there for processing immigrants was built, this was a federally owned and administrated piece of property?
Yes. Going back to the early 1800s, there was a fort there as well. I believe it was Fort Gibson that was built as part of the harbor defenses. It later became just sort of a munitions station. They stored lots of munitions there. The people in New Jersey did not like that because Ellis Island is very close to the shore of New Jersey, and there was always a great fear that there would be a big explosion there that would hit Jersey. So it was throughout most of the 19th century is owned by the federal government.
Yeah, I think that one detail that seems to be always mentioned in the history and the reviews that public hangings were held there.
Yeah, since it was owned by the federal government, one of the federal crimes that was federal capital crimes was piracy. And, you know, we talk about pirates, we think of Johnny Depp and the Pirates of the Caribbean and the eye patches. But, you know, I mean, pirates were basically people who took over ships on the high sea, and for a variety of reasons. One of the pirates that was hanged there, it was actually a slave ship. And it was like Amistad. These were slaves who had taken over the ship. They were going to be sent down either to New Orleans or further south as punishment. And they took over the ship. They were eventually captured. That was deemed a crime of piracy, and the ringleader was hanged at Ellis Island. And this was a big public spectacle. People would come with their boats. They would line the much smaller island at the time of less than 3 acres, and they would watch a public hanging. It was a public spectacle to it. It was entertainment in the days before movies and television. Hmm.
So when the decision was made to build this station to receive immigrants, was it just a natural that the government, federal government, said, well, we already own this property. It's right there. It's essentially in the right place where it needs to be. So why don't we go ahead and build it there?
Yeah, there was some talk about moving it to another federally owned island right next door, which is now known as Liberty Island, and the Statue of Liberty is on. But that caused an outcry because you have the statue there. So, yeah, so it became natural. This was an island which could therefore kind of remove the whole process of immigration inspection away from the hustle and bustle of Manhattan to an already owned federal island. It was close to the Jersey Shore as well, so there would be a train station there. So, yeah, so it seemed the natural spot. Hmm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Vincent Canato. He teaches history at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and is the author of a newly published history of Ellis Island. The title of his book is American Passage, published by Harper. Questions, certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I guess also we should make clear that not everyone who was coming to the United States on board a ship from Europe had to go through Ellis Island. How did they decide who had to go through this process and who did not?
That's correct. It's largely the people who went through Ellis Island were those who came in steerage or third class. The steamships of the time were kind of like our airplanes today. They had different classes, and you had to pay more for first class or second class as opposed to third class or steerage. So Ellis Island was for those who came in steerage or third class. If you were in first or second class, unless you were obviously sick or ill or had some other problem with paperwork or what have you, then when the steamship landed in Manhattan, all ships landed in Manhattan first, then you were free to go. You didn't have to go to Ellis Island. The steamships would have been boarded by public health officers in the harbor, actually in the Narrows, as it entered the harbor, and there would be an initial inspection of passengers. So that was, for most first and second class passengers, that was really all that they had to deal with. Now, a lot of first and second class passengers were tourists. They're just people coming to visit. So that was, I think, part of the rationale, that it didn't make sense to have them go through Ellis Island as well. And there were commissioners at Ellis Island who wanted to make all ship passengers go to Ellis Island. But the problem was that a lot of these people tend to be wealthier, tend to be more well-connected, and they did not like the idea of going to Ellis Island. There are stories of first- and second-class passengers at Ellis Island who complained tremendously. Often they were British, and they didn't like being stuck with the immigrant rabble. So they complained pretty loudly.
Hmm. As you say, the purpose of Ellis Island was to weed out people who were, quote-unquote, undesirable. And we can talk about what people thought that meant. But it seemed that, at least early on, the big issue was, were people healthy? Were they able-bodied? Were they able to work? Would they be able to support themselves? Or would they be somehow a burden on the state?
Those were the two biggest categories that would make someone undesirable, was that health issues, whether they had a contagious disease, or people, as the term was, deemed likely to become a public charge. What most Americans wanted immigrants for was work, was labor. Were these immigrants capable of labor? And it was mostly hard labor, factory work, mines, building roads, tunnels, and so forth. So the idea was immigrants had to be healthy, and they had to be willing and able to do work and not become wards of the state. This is prior to the welfare state, so what we're talking about largely is the poorhouse, asylums, or private charity.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that really strikes me is that given there were these kind of restrictions, and maybe later on there also were other kinds of concerns about people and who they were, that actually a very small percentage of the people who came to Ellis Island were sent back. Most everybody, like 98-99% of the people who came, they were allowed in.
That's correct. Most people don't realize that, as you say, 98-99% of immigrants who get to Ellis Island eventually are allowed to enter. Now, still, in some years, 1-2% in a year of a million, you're talking about close to 20,000 people sent back. Those are 20,000 tragedies and sad stories. But on the whole, almost everyone, 98-99% of people get in. And I think that's one of the ironies of American immigration. You know, we have these quote-unquote restrictive laws. And when you look at the laws during this period, you see all the classifications for exclusion. But on the other hand, you know, we're letting in most, almost all the people who get here. And it's the same, I think, with today. You know, we hear about the 1990s as you know, all the immigration restrictions, or restrictionists, all this anti-immigrant furor. Well, the 1990s were also a time of huge immigration to America. And I think that's one of the ironies. Now, part of the reason why so few immigrants were turned back was that Ellis Island was not the first immigration inspection station they had to go through. They would usually have to go through inspection at the European ports as well, and these were inspection stations put together and run by steamship companies. Steamship companies wanted to make sure that the people they sold tickets to would be able to get through Ellis Island.
Because they had to pay to send them back if they were to, if they were turned away.
Exactly. The federal government, Congress, was very smart. They said, okay, we're going to have all these categories for exclusion, and we're going to charge steamship companies to send these people back. It would be the responsibility of steamship companies. They'd have to pay a fine, and they'd have to pay for their medical care, for food, and to ship them back. So the steamship companies had a financial interest in making sure that they did not bring over, quote-unquote, undesirables. The law at the time would be posted at the European ports. It was well known. It was well understood who would not be allowed into America. It's kind of hard to find hard statistics on how many immigrants got sent back. I have in the book only kind of snapshots. For instance, one year at the port of Bremen in Germany, 60,000 immigrants were turned back in a year. So we do get the sense that there were immigrants who just were not even allowed to buy tickets to come over to America in the first place.
And though, again, was that because the people who ran the steamship companies were looking over these potential passengers and they were seeing that there was obviously something, that they had some obvious physical problem, they were sick? What would be their reason for saying to a person, no, I'm sorry, you may have the money, but we're not going to sell you a ticket?
Yeah, I mean, disease, sickness, or someone who might fall under likely to become a public charge. They didn't look like they would make it. They were sick or weakly, or you know, they were paupers. They were obviously poor, very poor, and not having the tools to make a living. So those would probably be the main reasons for being rejected.
How did they feel about people who were elderly?
Well, that's sort of a question. Obviously, you know, strict interpretation of the law, a lot of these elderly would not be allowed to come in because they would probably be likely to become a public charge. They couldn't work. There's a case in the book of an Italian immigrant who comes in. And he's destined to go to his son, who works, I think, somewhere in Virginia or West Virginia. And he's deemed likely to become a public charge. He's an old man. He can't work. But then the son comes up and to pick up his father. And you see this reunion, and it's nice, and obviously the son is going to take care of the father, so they let him in. So mostly, for the most part, the elderly who came, as long as they were coming to be with family, would be allowed in. But if they had a disease, that would be a different story. That's another. Then it would be trickier.
We have a couple of callers here. Let's start to talk with people who are listening. We'll start with someone in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Good morning. A fascinating topic, as always. I'm curious to know, there's a story in my family, possibly apocryphal, about how my great-great-grandfather stowed away on a ship, a cargo ship, going from Galway to New York. He had been kicked out of the house at the age of 12 because, you know, too many mouths to feed, and he was the best able to fend for himself, being the eldest. So he worked his way down the country, got to the port, and stowed away, and then had to work in the galley on the passage over, and the cook took pity on him and smuggled him off the ship on their last day in port in New York. And so I was curious to know if during this era there is any sort of a tradition or any sort of method by which people who, you know, were refused passage by the steamship companies could get to America via the cargo traffic. I'm particularly thinking of political radicals in this time. You had a lot of political radicals and communists exiting Germany, especially people who were not necessarily down with the project of Prussianization. Yeah, there are definitely stories of stowaways, very common. One of the famous cases, not actually in the book, but Bela Lugosi, the actor, initially comes to America as that same story. He comes in illegally as a member of the crew, and that was often very common. Crew members who would kind of just, you know, stay and then just kind of dissolve into American society. The other issue is I guess what we call illegal immigration today. You have stories of people who go to Canada, for instance, or would go into other ports where the inspection process was a lot more lenient. I've seen stories of that, most certainly. If you were a communist or a radical, there are actually no laws against communists or radicals. The only thing in the law was against anarchists. It was fairly specific. So, you know, if you were a socialist, and there were lots of socialists who came over during this period of time, until 1918, 1919, you really didn't have a problem.
That's interesting. And I suppose they told the anarchists because they had big bushy mustaches and a big bomb they were carrying with them, of course.
they actually asked on the ship's manifest, "Are you an anarchist?" And of course, the answer is no.
No, not at all.
Exactly. No, of course not. And then if you said yes, then you would be rejected for other reasons, having to do with probably low intelligence. But the anarchist thing is not so much that you could tell right away who's an anarchist, but there was also a deportation feature in the law. For the most part, in this period, it was up to 3 years. So there is a story in the book about this guy named John Turner, who was a fairly well-known English anarchist. Comes to America, gets through fine, but then starts giving speeches where he talks about anarchy. Then he's hauled back to Ellis Island and he's deported.
I'll ask one last question and get off the phone. What kind of papers did immigrants need to have to be able to successfully negotiate their way through American life? I mean, do they have to have a certificate from Ellis Island or something similar in order to do some of the basic things? And thanks very much for another fascinating topic.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, no, that's a very good question. They didn't actually have to have any paperwork as we know it, and they didn't receive anything from Ellis Island. There's kind of a misconception that immigrants were given these forms when they passed through Ellis Island, and then we can talk later about name changes. The only form that really came about was the ship's manifest, and what would happen years later when immigrants went to naturalize, officials would often go and look up the ship's manifest just to make sure that the person, you know, was who they say they were, or they came in legally, and all of that. But no, they were not given any certificate or any papers. Passports were in the very early stages at this time, so they weren't required to have a passport. The visa system doesn't come in until the 1920s, so no, the paperwork system is not. Is really not there.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that Ellis Island opened in 1892, but it wasn't until after World War I that you started to see quotas, and really in the 20s, maybe people looking more carefully, that is, the government looking more carefully at who people were. In the beginning, as we said, really the only thing that the government was concerned with was, as we said, are these people able-bodied? Do they have any kind of infectious disease? Can they work? And will they be able to support themselves and contribute to the American economy by working? That was pretty much it.
Well, actually, at the beginning, but over time, they increase the number of categories they're interested in. So anarchists gets added in 1903. Hmm. You get polygamists are added pretty early on. The terms idiot and imbecile, which were in the law, Congress writes this into immigration law, which had to do with low intelligence. You get prostitutes or women brought over for immoral purposes. You also have this term moral turpitude, which is a very broad and ambiguous term. Immigrants could be turned back if they were guilty of a crime of moral turpitude. So although most of the immigrants were sent back to disease or likely to become a public charge, there are more and more and more categories that get added to the law. There's a literacy test in 1970.
And that's also interesting that it was, at least at that point, in 1917, they tried to make some determination, can this person read? That is, in their own language, can they read? Did they do anything else to try to do some assessment of, let's say, this person's mental fitness?
Ellis Island is one of the first places in America that really begins the testing and implementation of IQ tests. Because written into the law, idiots or imbeciles were banned, and there's actually a medical definition of what an idiot or an imbecile is, the doctors at Ellis Island begin to create tests to test the mental acuity or the intelligence of these immigrants. If it was deemed on the initial line inspection that an immigrant was, let's say, might have low intelligence, and again, and how they would decide that is different is another. And then they would go through a battery of intelligence tests. Most of them were jigsaw puzzles, other kinds of nonverbal tests, questions, you know, count from 1 to 20, count from 20 to 1 backwards. These were all done through an interpreter. So, yeah, so the testing of intelligence, especially after around 1907, 1908, becomes more a bigger and bigger deal.
We're at our midpoint here. We have some callers we'll get right to. Our guest is Vincent Cannato. He teaches history at University of Massachusetts, Boston, and is the author of A New History of Ellis Island. The title of his book is American Passage. It's published by Harper. Let's talk with someone in Effingham here. Line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, David. three things. The as opposed to the communists, were the anarchists a more ready threat? And secondly, the Palmer raids of the 1920s, I think it was, that returned many communists to Europe. The overall situation with the Irish, when they immigrated, I've read pieces about, you know, the signs that no Irish need apply and discrimination against those folk. And the whole thing seemed to be fraught, you know, with kind of political and slave trade. I'll ring off and listen. Thank you.
Well, that certainly gets to the question of how it is that other Americans, people who were already here, thought about the newcomers.
Yeah, and it's funny, you mentioned the caller mentions the Irish. The Irish during this period of time, so from 1892 to the 1920s, are seen as the good immigrants. The anti-Irish sentiment is really part of the earlier Castle Garden period. So really from the 1840s and 50s, back then the Irish were seen as bad immigrants. They're the new immigrants. They're, you know, criminals and all this stuff. By 1900, the Irish are the good immigrants. And now we have a new set of bad immigrants. Those are usually the Southern Europeans or the Eastern Europeans. So that changes over time. And today, those Southern and Eastern Europeans are seen as good immigrants. And we have a new set of, quote-unquote, bad immigrants. So, and the ban on anarchists comes after the assassination of William McKinley in 1901. He's assassinated. He's killed by an anarchist, a man who claims to be an anarchist. So that's why it enters the law. And, yeah, the Palmer raids of the Red Scare were done, actually, the deportations were done through, not through the Justice Department, but it had to be done through what was then the Labor Department, which was in charge of immigration. Although J. Edgar Hoover, who's a big part of it, works for the Justice Department. He's working through the Immigration Service.
All right, let's talk with someone next in Champaign. Line 1, hello.
Yes, good morning. I know that my great aunt and my great uncle came to this country in about 1995. She was 12 and he was 14, and they came to work in the sewing shops. They had a trade. And I've often wondered, you know, how, if they went to Ellis Island, how they got from there to Chicago, which is where they set up a household. And also, my mother and grandmother came to join them in 1923. And I know that at that time, it was very difficult to get in unless you were joining family members. And by 1923, all the family was together except for my grandmother and mother. And I have a sad little story to tell about my mom. She came in 1923, and she had this wonderful auburn hair, which she had as a braid down her back. And the lady who examined her said, you know, you might have lice. I have to cut off your hair. And you didn't argue with the immigration officer. And so they cut off her hair, and then insult to injury, this lady handed it to my mother and said, you can keep it.
So it sort of sounds like it would defeat the purpose of cutting it off if
you
give it right back
so?
To the
yeah,
person.
It's like you did not argue with the immigration officer. That was, you know, not something that you did. So I'm curious, how did these Russian Jewish immigrants, were there societies that looked after them once they got to Ellis Island to get them around the country?
Yes, there definitely were what were called immigrant aid societies. For Russian Jewish immigrants, the main one was the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, HIAS. Every different ethnic group, religion, had some kind of organization at Ellis Island, and they were there to assist the immigrant through the process and help them get on their way.
Very interesting.
Yeah, they were. It's not just simply a case where the immigrants landed at Ellis Island and they were on their own. There were definitely people there who were there to help, were there to assist them, who had their interests in mind.
And it was called the Hebrew.
I'm sorry. Say that again.
It was called the Hebrew
Immigrant Aid Society.
HIAS.
AS, yeah. Or it's also known as Hebrew Immigrant Aid and Sheltering Society.
I always wondered about that, and that somehow I never got around to asking my great aunt about it.
That could be. But perhaps there were people in Chicago. I mean, it was common for immigrants to head west. There was a railroad station on the New Jersey side, and many immigrants landed there afterwards and took. Some of them went to, you know, the Dakotas, Wyoming, Missouri, Texas, you know, wherever. They went all around. Sometimes they were going to family. Perhaps there was someone, your family went out to Chicago. Perhaps there was someone there from their hometown.
Well, my great aunt and great uncle were the first.
But maybe there were people in Chicago that they knew from their hometown.
I don't know. I didn't ask. But I know my mother came. My mother and grandmother came to join the rest of the family by that time. Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
I'm curious. It's called the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society.
Very good. Well, thank you for the call. Let's go on to someone in Savoy here, line number two. Hello.
Good morning. After listening to the lady talk about her relative with the hair, I now have two things to comment on. Regarding the hair, obviously you all have seen the light there, and the point I wish to make is to call everybody's attention to the fact that most of the people working in the Humongo federal government aren't any brighter, and so every time you think you're going to solve some problem by expanding the federal government, you now see why it doesn't all that work out so well. Now, the main reason I called was to educate everyone about the morons, the imbeciles, and the idiots. Once upon a time, these were legitimate medical diagnoses, and they were not considered insults. The moron would be the mildly mentally retarded of today, the imbecile, the moderate, and the idiot, the profound and severe. It was only after average people got a hold of these terms and started throwing them around as pejoratives and insults that we got a problem from it. And that's about all I wanted to say.
Okay. Well, I guess it would be a much better world if we had more psychiatrists. Anyway, you want to comment on that at all, Mr. Cannato?
Well, I mean, the caller is correct. These were actual medical diagnoses. And he's right. A moron was a moron. The term moron is a created term. It dates to the early 1900s, created by a psychologist to define people who are of kind of borderline normal intelligence. They're just under the cutoff of normal. An imbecile is mildly, and then an idiot would be severely. And there were actually years. They classified people according to mental ages. So I think an idiot was from a mental age of 2 to 5. An imbecile, I believe, was 5 to 8. and a moron was 8 to 12 years. So these were actual medical terms, medical definitions for them.
Let's talk with another call here. Champagne, line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I have a kind of a personal question. I came over to the United States in 1949 when I was 7 with my parents and my grandmother on her mother's side. We spent 5 years in Germany as displaced persons, having fled Lithuania from the Russians. And we got a sponsor to sponsor us to the States from Boston. I remember coming over in a Navy ship because I remember playing on the guns, and I remember passing the Statue of Liberty. And I'm pretty sure we went through Ellis Island. And I have tried to find a record at Ellis Island of when we came in, but I can't seem to locate anything. I wonder if you have an internet site that might help me do that.
Yeah, you're probably not going to find anything at Ellis Island or on the Ellis Island website. Those are largely going to be ship's manifests for those immigrants who came over during the peak period of time by ship, as an immigrant. What I would probably suggest is, I don't know, the caller came over as a DP, a displaced person,
right,
which is a different category. And my best suggestion was that probably check the National Archives, and maybe you could give a call to the National Archives either in Washington or there might be a local branch. There might be a local branch in Chicago, I don't know for certain. And see if they have displaced persons records from this period of time.
And is there any particular arm of the National Archives I should ask for?
That's a good question. No, because I'm not sure whether it would come under the INS or not. I mean, you might want to say, if you explain the situation, displaced persons after World War II, possibly under the INS, the Immigration Naturalization Service papers. You might want to see if I'm sure there's paperwork for it, but it would come under it would be not with the rest of the immigration.
Uh-huh.
Call the National Archives. Say you're interested in finding information about displaced persons after World War II. They have anything on that.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge, and the guest this morning is Vincent Canato. He teaches history at University of Massachusetts, Boston. He is the author of a recently published history of Ellis Island. The title of his book is American Passage, and it's published by Harper. And we have about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Just one thing real quick I wanted to have you talk about. I'm sure that in many families there is this story where they say, we came to Ellis Island and we were there and some official looked at our name and decided it was too difficult, too long, unpronounceable, too foreign, whatever, and that person changed it. So that is how we started out as one thing when we were in Europe, and when now that here we're in the United States, we have another name. My sort of understanding is that actually that didn't really happen, or maybe it didn't happen as much as people said that it did.
It is probably the most common story I hear, and one of the biggest misconceptions about Ellis Island, which is that our family's name was changed there. And immigrant names were definitely changed. I mean, there are many stories of immigrants. For instance, my last name was originally Kanata with an A. Now it's with an O. But with very, very rare exceptions, I can't prove a negative. Very few, if any, names were changed at Ellis Island. Immigrants were not given a piece of paper, saying, here you go, here's your new name. What the inspectors and the clerks did was read over the ship's manifests. The names were already written down. All the name was written down in Europe by the steamship company. And they were merely trying to ascertain whether that information was correct. They were interviewing the immigrant. So my guess is that immigrants who had their names changed might have had their names changed in Europe by the steamship companies, but even that, the ship's manifest is an illegal document. It doesn't legally change a name. They most likely had their names changed after Ellis Island, either when they went to become naturalized citizens and filled out paperwork, or immigrants themselves often changed their names. They tried to fit in and Americanize their names. And my guess is that years later, some immigrants maybe felt bad about that. And it's much more convenient to blame inspectors at Ellis Island for that. But it was very common to change one's name, to Americanize one's name.
All right, let's go to another caller here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
The lady was saying something about how people were helpful to him at Ellis Island. I came to the United States as a 17-year-old together with my mother and stepfather in 1956. And I don't want to say something very funny, but it is a fact that some people helped themselves other than the immigrants. We took a taxi from the pier to the bus station, Central Bus Station, Greyhound, and they charged us $7 a person. And so with my sister and a couple of other older folks that were traveling with us, we had to pay $42 for a taxi ride that was a couple of blocks. So I learned something early, and I have, in the meantime, forgiven the taxi driver, and I'm glad I'm here. But I'm telling you, there are some people that were bad also. They weren't all just the good people helping.
Well, what's that? I'm sure that that's true. Professor Canato, you want to take that and go with it?
That is a story that's been going on for 150 years.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. You know. Anyway, I had to say that. First time I ever called into a talk show. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, I'm sure that that is correct, that there were people who were interested in trying to help newcomers, and I'm sure there also were people who were interested in trying to take advantage of newcomers. I'm sure even some of the people at Ellis Island took advantage of newcomers. Some of the staff there, because there were concerns over time about corruption, bribe-taking, and so forth.
Especially in the 1890s, there was a corruption investigation which accused a number of people there of taking bribes. There was accusations against the money change, the business that owned the money change. They were ripping off immigrants. There was complaints about the railroad ticket office. There were always complaints that people were taking advantage of immigrants. Not to mention, as this caller says, once they leave Ellis Island, once they go into New York, and then they're at the mercy of taxi drivers and others who are looking to take advantage of them.
Hmm. What, at the time that Ellis Island was operating and there were people there from various kind of relief agencies on the island trying to help newcomers, did the government do anything to try to make sure that those people who were offering to help the newcomers were legitimate?
Yes, and that was part of the corruption investigation. In the early 1900s, there were some immigrant aid societies who were banned from Ellis Island because the government officials believed that they were taking advantage, even though under the guise of helping immigrants, that they were taking advantage of immigrants. So there were a few societies who were banned.
All right, let's talk with another caller. This is Urbana, line two.
Hi, this is a follow-up question to your discussion on name change. I'm actually trying to track down any official paperwork regarding my grandfather's change of name in my application for dual citizenship, and I don't know if a legal document's going to exist or not. It doesn't seem to be with his application for naturalization papers.
Well, what's the name on the naturalization paper?
It's the anglicized name.
So were you able to track down his ship's manifest?
Yeah, that still has the name from Italy.
Okay, so probably between the time that your ancestor left Ellis Island and the time that he decided to become naturalized, it could have been right when he decided to naturalize. He might have just said, this is the name I want to go by, or maybe officials said, why don't you change your name?
My guess is it's earlier than that because I've gotten directories of a business he ran and such that used the anglicized name. So I didn't know if citizens just changed their name at will, and then when they filed for immigration, even though their birth papers might have had a different name, they were still able to be naturalized?
I don't know. That's a good question, because clearly he would have to then prove when he naturalized that he was the same person as the person on the ship's manifest.
Right.
The old name. Whether there was an intermediate step where he went to Prost to get to say, I'm changing my name, my guess is probably not. I don't know for certain, but I would be surprised if there was a document there that you would find.
Okay, thank you.
All right. We have maybe about 5 minutes left here in this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Vincent Cannato. He's a historian at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, author of a new book, American Passage, that is the history of Ellis Island. Ellis Island was closed in 1954. Why did they close it then?
The official reason was there was a money-saving move by the federal government. There were very few immigrants that were, this was a low period of time for immigration. There were few immigrants that were being processed there. It had mostly become a detention center for those who were not being let into the country or being deported back. But I think another reason why it was closed was because it had attracted a lot of bad publicity in the 50s. There were a couple of famous cases of detainees, a woman named Knaus and a man named Mezzi. And both of them were detained for a couple of years at Ellis Island. And they were both accused some variation of being communists or radicals. And their cases went all the way to the Supreme Court. And during this period of time, Ellis Island becomes known as a concentration camp, which is not a good thing to be called after World War II. The Soviets actually make some hay out of the out of Ellis Island and the fact that it's a concentration camp. It begins to have some bad connotations to it. So I think because it wasn't really being used very much, because it was getting a lot of bad press, and because the government could save some money, they just closed it up and they moved the operations of the Immigration Service to Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. And having said that, there certainly were some celebrated cases of people who got stuck there for a variety of reasons, maybe political mostly. I think it's also true, though, that most of the people who came through Ellis Island, unless they were sick and were hospitalized, most people, you know, maybe they were there for a couple hours and then they moved on.
Yeah. The idea of today, a lot of people look at Ellis Island as a shrine almost. It's become a national icon. But I think for a while, a lot of people did not, in the 50s, didn't see Ellis Island as a shrine. They saw it as a place that they went through for a couple of hours and that was about it. In addition to that, the 50s were a time when many immigrants or second-generation Americans were busy assimilating and Americanizing. They weren't too interested in their immigrant path. They weren't looking back to the old world. They were looking forward. So the idea of going genealogy for these first and second-generation immigrants really didn't exist. They weren't busy trying to conserve their past. They were looking forward. So it's not until really the 1970s that these people start saying, oh, wait a second, let's look back to the past. Let's look back at our immigrant grandparents. Let's look back at what they went through.
So for something like 20 years, it was just falling apart. Then it was at that point where people were starting to think more about their heritage, that people started thinking that this was an historic place and was some place that was in need of preservation?
Exactly. I mean, it's not just closed. It's actually abandoned, and the place is pretty much left to rot, and it's in real bad shape. And what happens is, part of it's the civil rights movement. Ironically enough, the idea that that difference is good, that diversity is good, multiculturalism, all these things are sort of good values. Then you get roots. Average Americans become much more interested in looking at the roots of their ancestors. And you get this revival of ethnic identity. You know, kiss me, I'm Irish. Kiss me, I'm Polish. You get the movie The Godfather. You get all the stuff that comes out in the 1970s that leads to people saying, wait a second, what is this place? You know, I heard my grandfather talk about this place, Ellis Island. What is this? Oh, you know, look at it. Maybe we should do something about it.
Well, the main building there has been restored, and it's open for visitors, so you can go there, and people do. What can you see there today?
It is now, it's part of the National Park Service, and it is largely a museum to American immigration. There are some very nice exhibitions on the Ellis Island experience, on immigration in general, there's photographic exhibits about the island. It's a beautifully restored building. So that's pretty much what you're going to see once you get there. But you will notice that there are probably 24 or more buildings on the south side of the island that are not renovated, that have not been restored. And they are pretty much in the same place they've been for the last 40-plus years. there's been a drive to try to renovate and restore those buildings as well.
And that's mostly there. Those that's mostly the what were the healthcare,
medical
things for the time.
Yeah. Exactly. Mostly it's the medical facilities, the hospitals, contagious disease hospitals. They were built a little bit later, and those are mostly on the south side of the island. And those are still closed off to the public.
Just to touch on that for a second, because we did talk earlier about the fact that the screening, at least initially, a lot of the screening had to do with trying to find out were people healthy. And one of the reasons for someone being sent back would be is if they were sick or infirm or found to be mentally deficient, or the judgment was made that this person would become a burden on the state. If, though, people were found to be ill, to be sick, and it was determined that they could be made well, they actually were taken care of, and then if people got better, they got over whatever it was, then they were allowed in.
Exactly. A lot of people don't realize that immigrants would stay there for weeks, sometimes months, not just in detention, but in hospitals, while officials waited to see whether they would improve, their health would improve. The doctors were kind of in a bind, because a doctor is mainly there to heal people. But doctors at Ellis Island also had the job of sort of deciding whether immigrants, or at least an initial decision about whether immigrants were healthy or not. But there was also the healing aspects of the hospital. Doctors there worked to help immigrants, help them get better. And for many immigrants, it was the best health care they had ever received.
What sort of conditions would people come with, treatable conditions?
Well, two of the biggest conditions that people were sent back for was something called trachoma, which is basically conjunctivitis, sort of an inflammation in the back of the eyelid.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was something called falvis, which was a kind of a bacterial infection at the head, scalp, which caused people to lose their hair. You know, any kind of illness. Well, I mean, it could just be the flu or just a regular illness if someone was running a temperature. Whatever it may be, they were sent to the hospital and it was there where they'd be treated. Pregnant women, we don't think of that as a disease or a sickness, but pregnant women would then go to the hospital and would have their child there before leaving.
Well, there's much more in this book that people can go out and find. The title of the book is American Passage, The History of Ellis Island. Harper is the publisher. The author, our guest, Vincent Cannato, he teaches history at the University of Massachusetts at Boston. And thanks very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks very much, David. I enjoyed it.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. And indeed, we have big audio archives from Focus 580, the afternoon magazine, our local production. It's on our website for you to listen anytime that you're ready. So go there and take a look at it. It's will.illinois.edu. Focus 580, this program, is supported in part by Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Now with four area locations, including inside the new Activities and Recreation Center north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com. Coming up in the next part of Focus 580, we'll be talking to someone who increasingly has been known for his work in providing for and working towards interfaith dialogue. Eboo Patel is his name. And his book, Acts of Faith, is a book that was given out as part of the Illini Union's One Book, One Campus program this year. All incoming U of I students got a copy. He'll be here on the campus next week, and we'll talk about him in the next hour of Focus 580, and we will take calls. First, though, we'll break for an update on the news and markets, so stay tuned.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Thank you. 8 is up 4 3/4. March 5/23 is up 1. December corn is at 3.68 1/4, down 2.5. March 3.81 1/2, down 1.5. July 4.01 is up 1.5. December crude oil 78.05 is down 1.50. November ethanol 1.93 is down 5 cents. The November RBOB is at $2.08, and is down.